Welcome back. This is Take Charge of Your Health with Corinne Fornari, clinical nutritionist and physician assistant, and my co-host, Carol Peterson, pharmacist. Every week, we present you with new and creative ways to help you make sense of health information and bring it home to you and your family. With years of clinical experience between us and research into traditional and cutting-edge technologies, we give you practical information to help you take charge of your health. Welcome back. Welcome back. We're here. I'm here with my co-host. I'm Corinne Fornari.
Hi, Carol Peterson.
Pharmacist. And so we've got a very interesting show today. It came about by the fact that I went on the internet and I was on YouTube and I was seeing multiple conversations on female hormone therapy. Most of these people, all by doctors, and they're very well-meaning, one of them, but at the same time, there are so many misconceptions that are really being spread by misinformation. And we, Carol and I then went over them and we were just stunned by the information that was being put out. There's this one talk and it's by Dr. Huberman and Peter Alta.
And Peter Attia.
Attia. I always put an L in there instead of a T. I like the other name better. And they're both very well-known and quite credentialed professionals. And they were having a discussion on hormone therapy. Dr. Attia was literally the expert, and Huberman was asking him questions. And Attia started out, and he started out by saying he feels one of the worst things that have happened in medicine was the misconception that was created by the Women's Initiative study in 2000, and how it changed people's mind and understanding and created fear in women in relationship to hormones. And I looked down, and as I often do, at comments, and I want to read a couple of them. And just one starts out was, your opening comment also made me cry, Dr. Attia, because he talked about the misconceptions. Heartfelt and thank you. And then it goes on how she's gone looking for care and hasn't been able to find it. The next one is, I contemplated taking my life because I was taught that hormone replacement therapy can cause breast cancer. My goodness. And after suffering for a long, I asked for help and thankfully, no questions asked was presented with hormone replacement therapy and all my symptoms resolved. Then it went on, hormone replacement therapy saved my life. Depression gone, hot flashes gone, sleepless nights gone, anxiety gone, food craving gone, and I could go on and on and on. Now, then let me continue. My OBGYN acted like I was crazy when I started complaining of symptoms in my 40s, and I knew there was something wrong. There was. I had no hormones. In my body. It took years to find someone who would help me. Now I have my life back. Wow. And that's just three of 4,000. Plus, many of these have 20 responses, and those responses are saying, yes, I experienced that, or yes, I understand exactly what you're saying. So, Carol, I think this is a real unanswered question. And but more than being unanswered, it is misunderstood even by the experts who have a lot of sympathy for the problem. So where do we want to begin? This is big. And also, it is so big, and we saw your comments. So the number to call in is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. We want you to call in with your experiences and your question, and we're here. Go on, Carol. Why not begin this?
Okay, so Dr. Atiya is a very prolific podcaster and interviewer. So he carries big clout, and he's gone into becoming very interested in longevity. So people like to hear him. He's a pretty fit guy himself. He presents with authority, which to my mind is a problem, because I want to also present with authority here. But I think Dr. Atiya was really, really mistaken in a lot of areas. So he talks about the Women's Health Initiative having a very negative effect, and so it has, with people becoming more and more confused about hormone therapy. But the fact of the matter is, hormones were not used in this in this study. What was used was Premarin and Provera. Premarin being extracted, hormones extracted from horse's urine. Now, we call it estrogen, but the fact of the matter is, exactly, there have been over 60 hormone-like molecules identified in Premarin. Some of them have estrogenic activity. Some have progesterone-like. There's no equivalent to human progesterone. There are some human equivalent estrogens in there, but the far majority are horse-related ones. And there's some androgens too, testosterone type ones.
Can I just add to that? The body, sure, because they're horse estrogens, they're very strong, and they cling very tight to the receptor sites, and our body can't break them down. Our body takes weeks trying to break them down. In the process of breaking them down, they concentrate them and make them even stronger until it's finally excreted. So this is a very important point. Go on, Carol.
Okay, so then he says it's one of the biggest health disasters. I would say yes, maybe. I think maybe cholesterol is, and we'll cover that soon. But just as a preview. So one of the first things, he sort of dazzles Dr. Huberman with the fact that if you look at hormone tests, they're expressed in different units, and estrogen does not occur as much as testosterone. So testosterone is about 10 times the amount of the estrogens. And then, so he leaves it there, ignoring progesterone, which is even more, 10 times the testosterone, like 1,000 times the estrogen in the follicular level, the first part of the cycle. When progesterone is at its lowest, it's 1,000 times the estrogen. And that's a problem with units too. But this seems to fly off the radar. He like hones in on testosterone. Well, guess what? Women have more testosterone than estrogen. Well, how exciting and how surprising. But he says progesterone flatlines in the first part of the cycle.
Exactly. It does nothing.
It does nothing. That's his nothing. Words exactly.
His,
what's the matter with this picture?
Yeah, the microphone, Carol, because there's a lot to talk about. Go on.
So such a big gap. He likes to measure hormones. He says on day five, day one.
My big complaint. Go on.
Oh, well, why don't you go on that one?
Day five is generally the time you measure hormones when you're trying to look at fertility and pregnancy. It's not the time you look at hormones to look at balance. I always looked from when I checked hormones, if I had only one reading or the ability to only get one reading. I mean, you could take them every single day, but it's very expensive and difficult to do. But if I could only get one reading, I'd do them either at or right after the week after ovulation, when hormones are peaking and we're understanding how the hormones are responding to stimulation. And you get a very good picture that way. Go on, Carol.
If ovulation has occurred, yes or no, you're not going to find that on day five.
No, exactly.
Sometimes you really want to know that.
And you want to know how they balance each other. Go on.
Right. So then he goes on to say, and I'll say this, I worked with a compounding pharmacy and we specialized in PMS. He says, it's the last 7 days, the seven days prior to the first day of bleeding, that PMS symptoms appear. No way, Jose. Definitely throughout the whole luteal cycle when progesterone is supposed to be peaking because you ovulated. If you have not ovulated, progesterone is really deficit. If you have ovulated, there are some reasons where women simply don't produce the abundance of progesterone they should have, and they can be symptomatic. My experience all these years was from the mid-cycle, when you're supposed to ovulate, all the way into 1, 2, 3 days of bleeding, these symptoms can occur. Now, what's your experience, Corinne?
Very much so. My experience is even before ovulation, that it's almost like a preamble or to what's going to happen, and it begins. And then at ovulation, you can have an extreme shift in your brain and your attitude and your depression and your like this woman said, she felt suicidal. And he also very directly, so PMS can start earlier. He said two other things. He said that he only gives progesterone the last 7 days, right before the period.
Or sometimes for 14, which is the normal deal.
Very occasionally. He said people can be very severely reactive to progesterone. But he also said that there's no proof of progesterone having an effect on the brain and that that needs to be studied.
Well, he also said that women are susceptible to brain effects like the PMS symptoms because of so much progesterone.
Yeah.
And this particular assumption that progesterone is the culprit because it's supposed to be high in the luteal phase and we need to somehow suppress the progesterone is a falsity. Something is going on with progesterone. You may not be making enough progesterone for your needs, or your estrogen is particularly excessive, or you've got all sorts of strange estrogens burdening your body. But the truth of the matter is, if you give progesterone and you give generous, very generous amounts of progesterone during the luteal phase, and there are symptoms like anxiety and headache and panic, breast tenderness, water retention. If you give progesterone, guess what? It all disappears. So how can progesterone be the culprit, especially in these mood things, when it's so easy with adequate and generous amounts of progesterone to supplement if you need it, in hours, so, you can't have anxiety relief. So where's the boogeyman progesterone?
So there's one, and since we're piling on, there's another pile on. He said something, he's very conservative with testosterone for women.
Are you jumping to testosterone? We're not done with progesterone.
No, we're going to go back. I'm going to circle it back. Okay.
All right.
So he
You're
said,
good at that.
Yeah, we're going to circle it back. He said that there are no studies showing the benefit of testosterone for women. And this talk was done this year. There were over 1 million people who listened to this talk, over 1 million in 1 year. And so when he said that, I stopped the broadcast and I went to PubMed and I typed in testosterone replacement in female benefits, and up came 2,532 responses for different studies. Now, some of them are better than others, but it is a subject that is being very well studied for bone, for brain, for energy, for alertness, for IQ in males and females. So these are all very important points. So I would like to just circle back and begin from the beginning now that we told all the problems.
well, that's definitely false. Some years ago, probably maybe even 2 decades ago, I went to a North American Menopause Society meeting. Now, this is one of the big, very pharma supported groups about menopause. So yeah. I would tread with caution looking at what they're writing. But they brought Dr. Susan Davis to speak, and she's an Australian researcher. And she had tons and tons of evidence for very successful supplementation of testosterone in women. There have been several companies going to the FDA trying to get a testosterone supplement approved. The FDA has a very negative opinion of helping women with testosterone. So the only options in the U.S. is either compounding or using male forms of testosterone, quite strong ones, and trying to use a little bit of it. That's your options.
Then there are the pellets also.
Oh, yeah, that's not so great.
Then one other thing.
Wait. You're going through a rabbit hole here that Peter Attia never went to. So let's stick to Peter. And I want to go back
Let me say one other thing he said. He said he's talked about that he really doesn't, he doesn't give birth control pills generally, but he recommends IUDs with progesterone.
Okay, so you're going out of context here a little bit.
So I went out and I looked up all the IUDs and I could not find one with progesterone.
Of course, there is no such thing.
Exactly. I found them for progestins, but no progesterone. So let's start over now that we piled on. And
let's ask our callers to call in.
Oh, yes.
212-209-2121. 2877.
Yes, 212-9287.
We look forward for you jumping into this discussion. And you might realize we're a little outraged here. And
Well, yeah, from the fact that this is so widely listened to. And now the part is, Atiyah is not ignorant. He's very sharp, but he's really... And then I listen in preparing, I listen to three or four other talks on menopause and hormone replacement. And they were, most of them, even worse than this one. And so it's very frustrating, because what you hear, and you hear it in the comments, that women are really desperate to get help. And yet... the information they're receiving is so limited. Atiyah feels that you keep on doing blood tests till you find that they're in menopause. You follow the FSH, and only then do you start hormones. What do you think of that, Carol?
Well, the first symptoms that appear usually are hot flashes, night sweats, the vasomotor symptoms, and they're occurring pretty early. And at your example, the woman in her 40s, I'm sure that was one of her complaints. The first hormone to drop, which was entirely ignored by Dr. Atiyah because it has no consequence and does nothing the first part of the cycle, of course.
Exactly.
So that's the first hormone to drop. As women are experiencing missed ovulations, they still bleed. And he spoke about that's happening because progesterone and estrogens drop toward the end of the luteal phase. I'm suspicious that it's only the estrogen drop that brings on the bleeding, because you can actually give progesterone very large amounts and it doesn't drop at all, and your menstrual cycle starts. I've had concrete evidence of this over and over again, but there's probably a PhD in this if you wanted to prove this particular point. But you can actually bleed and not have ovulated. So he said, he's quite cavalier about it. Oh, that'll pass in about 5 years, couple of years, and the vasomotor stuff passes. I went to University of Wisconsin once had this like series of things from the Women's Health Department on menopause. So it was for the public, a bunch of people there. One lady spoke up. She was in her 80s. She said, "I still have hot flashes. I can't sleep." Well, what's up with that, Dr. Atiyah? You're not paying attention to. No, it doesn't necessarily go away. And in some women, it can actually worsen as they go along.
And but, they can start when you're 35.
That's right. But you can get relief by restoring the hormone that's probably dropped. That is 1,000 times the amount of estrogens, which is progesterone, has a great deal to do with this. But so does other things, insulin, glucose, thyroid. It's another big difficulty with the whole menopause picture, because menopause is not a lack of estrogen. It's not the thing. And hence, we have some of these problems. On the other hand, we can have some real problems with women not getting treated with estrogen who really need it. He does say brain fog is cleared up with estrogen. I agree with that. Long-term vaginal symptoms. If you want a symptom to really monitor for whether your body has enough estrogen or not, there's nothing like the vaginal tissue. You need to be gushy and juicy, and the tissue needs to be healthy. I heard Dr. David Rosensweet say, when he tells his patients he's no longer doing the gynecologic exams, he asks his patients to ask the gynecologist to tell them what the state of the vaginal tissue is in relationship to your 25-year-old vagina? And I think this would be a good question for women to ask, whether you're on hormones, not on hormones, wherever you are in your life, what's your vagina doing in relationship to your younger self? Younger self.
I've seen many women their vaginas were pale, almost white pale, and so dry that it was difficult to get a speculum in. And so we stopped because it was too painful. We stopped the exam and we used low-level estrogen topically. And 2 weeks later, we had a very successful Pap. And that's important to understand. These women hadn't really been given an option of hormones, and yet they were really suffering. They were not able to be sexual because it was too painful. But at the same time, once a very low level of hormone was given, everything changed on them, and their life changed also. So this is not only about sexuality. This is about life and quality of life. And there's something else, that there's another reason why doctors try to, or hesitate, why medical people hesitate to give hormones, because they say that hormones, and this Dr. Atiyah did say, and I was really impressed with this, because they say that hormones increase clotting and estrogen specifically. Well, Atiyah said that's a misnomer. It does not increase clotting. When you take it orally, it increases clotting, but ever so slightly. But when you take it topically, what they found is it decreases clotting. So what you're having is a cardiovascular protective effect of the hormones when they're topical.
Okay, I've got a bone to pick with that. So for the most part, these studies have oral estrogen is the Premarin, which I just told you. Okay. We have just tons of estrogens. They're not identical to human. Your body hangs on to them, creates all kinds of increases in inflammatory markers. And then they run a study, and they'll compare it to estradiol topical, which is your main ovarian estrogen. So where are the oral estradiol to topical in gels or patches? Where are those studies? And there actually are some, and it doesn't show the damage with the clotting factors and the inflammation that Premarin does. It's either much, much less with oral estradiol or equivocal, maybe not any change at all. So another symptom of bad science, and then people talk about oral estrogen across the board, but is your own natural type the problem, that the Premarin is the problem, or the oral estrogens that are in the birth control pills, which are completely synthetic? So no fault in what you were saying, Corinne, because this kind of stuff is prevalent in the literature. I was asked to review a Lancet study about breast cancer incidence with various hormone therapies, many which are not true hormones. And this is like meta study with hundreds and thousands of women. And you can't make heads or tails of the information, because you have no idea what's going on. What did this person take? For how long did they really need it? There's a million questions that you don't have answered. Yet this study will, like, maybe AI all this data and come to some conclusion, but it's information that's not really based on sound science, like what's exactly going on with that individual, and you put them in this mass data point with hundreds of thousands of different things, what does that amount to? So it's meta analysis with combining all these studies is a very popular thing for some people to do. And it's looking to hopefully get some good information out of it. But the truth is, you still can't apply that to the individual. You don't have enough information from these studies. So terrible thing. But that's one bone I have to pick with the oral estrogen versus topical estrogen. If somebody's talking about it, make sure it's not Premarin versus the estradiol patch, for instance.
So what I have seen in working with women is that hormones can change their life. I used to have a psychiatrist that would send patients to me, and he said, I would work with them and work with the women and work with the women, and they couldn't hold any changes. And once their hormones got balanced, I would work with them and their changes would hold. And their understandings, they were able to make them work in their life. So I have seen, I can give story after story after story of how women's lives changed when they were given a balanced, not an extra physiologic amount, but a normal physiologic amount of hormone that creates a balance within their body. But there's something else he said, Carol, that I wanted to ask you about or bring up to you. He said he gives only 100 to 200 milligrams of progesterone and says that can be life-changing for women, and I've seen that also. But he also said that some people react to progesterone. Now, how would you respond to that?
I've written a whole blog on that. If you want to go to my website, the Wellness by Design Project, I wrote a blog. The title is something like When Women Don't Like Progesterone. And there's a number of reasons for it. But a really big one is an underdose for your needs. And this 100 to 200 milligram, according to Dr. Jerry Lynn Pryor, who's been a big researcher in the menstrual cycle, that's not enough to protect your bones. Why are you shortchanging women with this smaller dose? And maybe it is. I'd like to also. So you really have to peel through the layers and look at the underlying reason. If progesterone's been a problem, a huge thing is underdosing, a huge thing is candida overgrowth. So there's many more things you can look into. Like, don't just stop there and lose the benefits of progesterone. Look into what's actually happening to the individual. I wanted to say something else about the Women's Health Initiative that he said that he was criticizing them for using older women, but he said they were wanting to see how many women died, so they picked that older women. That was interesting. Wasn't that interesting?
It was. So, many of them, actually the majority of them, were asymptomatic. So you couldn't follow symptoms or symptoms being resolved with this study.
But so we said, and I would say, I think they were symptomatic, but he said like 30 to 40% were smokers and had diabetes. Hello. Diabetes is full of hormone deficiencies, particularly thyroid and testosterone. They were not without symptoms. You don't, this diabetes is not a symptom-free situation. And they really didn't look. They didn't evaluate the women in this study. Where were their hormones when they started? Where were they when they ended up? They never checked any of that. And so
it really was a sloppy study for all the money they put into it.
Yep. And I just came across when this podcast was done. It was August 2022. Peter Attia and Dr. Andrew Huberman. It's not been that long ago. Mm-mm. Corinne?
No. And it has not been that long ago. And to get such response told us that we really, women feel so neglected in so many ways in their health and health care. And they really have been fed misconceptions and fears in relationship to balancing hormone therapy. Hormone therapy becomes very relevant as our lives get longer, as we want more from our lives, as, you know, my grandmother, great grandmother, when they were 50, they started sitting on a couch, knitting and crocheting. They really, they didn't have the concept of going skiing with the grandchildren or playing outside with the grandchildren per se. Very little. They cooked, they knit, they crocheted, they sewed. But within our life, we demand more out of our life. And they also, although they were very, very smart, they brought up their children in a very intelligent way. They weren't challenging themselves intellectually, at least the grandparents that I knew. They had stopped. They had gone into decline, but not negative, but just into decline. They were ready. Whereas we have a different relationship to life. And within that different relationship to life, within that, we are able to look to a bioidentical hormone that keeps us supports our intellectual curiosity, that keeps our skin pliable, that helps reduce depression, keeps us feeling sexual and sexually active. There's something very important that he said that I wanted to bring up to you, Carol, was he said that there's no known way. They don't understand what progesterone does on the brain. And so, yet, what we see is depression resolves, or can, headaches resolve, and I can go on and on. Thyroid helps to be balanced, all with progesterone. So, but do you have any idea or an understanding of progesterone in the brain? I know it works on GABA receptors and allows the body to uptake GABA more effectively, which is a calming amino acid and a calming hormone. But go on, Karen.
As is progesterone, which does act on those receptors. You know, the whole thing in the brain is really complicated. DHEA, estrogens, pregnenolone, progesterone, testosterone, they are all active in the brain. They haven't even gone into general circulation. And they're busy doing stuff right there. Your brain creates all these hormones by itself directly from cholesterol and uses it right there. I found a really interesting book by, strangely enough, the author's name was Stephen King. The name of the book was Neurosteroids. And he reviewed about 10 years of research into these steroids, which are the ones I just mentioned, the progesterone, DHEA, pregnenolone, estrogens, how they work and where they work in the body, not in the body, excuse me, the brain exclusively. And it was really, really fascinating because not only is this all very complicated, like one hormone might have more potency in one part of a brain over the other brain, but some of these hormones can do opposite things depending on their concentration and where they are in the brain. It's not for the weak of heart for reading a book like this. It's so intensely complicated. We like to have easy answers on, off, up, down, and we don't have that here. And our medical system, which is based on kind of flowchart, yes and no, simply can't deal with the complexity of how could something in one concentration, for example, do one thing and do the opposite thing in another concentration. Well, this stuff does go on in the brain with these hormones. So it's a very complicated thing. And Dr. Atiyah is right. We don't have a way to measure this. I mean, they're having to do these studies under very complicated conditions. So interesting, but still it's a frontier as far as our scientific and medical understanding of the hormones in the brain are still very much.
I remember many years ago, one of my patients, her uncle was a GYN at Boston Hospital, the big Boston hospital. He was out of Harvard, and she said she was on natural hormones. And he said, "Oh, they're useless." He said, "You can't control them." Exactly. And I said to her, "I know, that's what's so good about them. Your body will adjust them. So if you're lying on a beach in the Bahamas and you're taking a certain dose, you could be very satisfied with that dose and feel very comfortable. But if you're taking tests in a graduate school and your mother's in the hospital, you could end up with hot flashes. Why? Because you don't have enough hormone to balance you and to allow you to get through this area or this time in your life. But if your natural body would create that adjustment if you are making appropriate hormones at that time. And your body is constantly adjusting itself to the time of month, to the amount of sleep you get, to the amount of stress you're under. We know that the body will convert progesterone, cortisol. And so progesterone is like a donor hormone, and it's there to give to cortisol in case of emergency. So here you are in stress, very high stress, and your progesterone goes down. Therefore, you even when you're trying to relax, your body can't relax because it doesn't have enough progesterone to calm the brain. So no, you can't control them. And that's why I love topical hormones, because women can adjust them on their own. They find the dose that's right for them that month or during that time. And they make it through. And sometimes they even lower their dose, but that's okay. It's what they feel good on that's important.
For the most part, because there is really no good test. The test, the proof is in the pudding, how you feel in the end and what hormone-related symptoms have disappeared. And it can be something as simple as the quality of your skin improving when you restore hormones. Dr. Atiyah brought up sleep. And this is another problem that women face quite a bit, and it has repercussions throughout the whole endocrine system. We start seeing sleep problems early on when progesterone starts becoming deficient, and progesterone can be magical for restoring, for being redundant, restorative sleep. So, Corinne, how about your experience with progesterone and sleep in your practice?
Well, I used to do this, with you. When you were in the pharmacy, when women couldn't sleep well, I would get a liquid progesterone in an oil, sometimes in olive oil, sometimes in a liquid. And the most they could make at that time was 5 milligrams per drop. And I used to buy it. I used to get it for my patients, and they would put drops under their tongue until they felt calm and were able to go to sleep. So, and I said, don't worry about it. You can use as much as you need. And they would start maybe with a dropper full, and then it would progress, and they would be on one drop a night, and that's all they would need. It was really a beautiful way to adjust sleep with really quite low doses relatively. What do you think?
It's quite interesting. One of the things that you referred to there is let the person be in charge of what's going to produce the effect that you wanted. So you gave your patients complete control of how much progesterone they needed to sleep. And over time, they adjust it. And you can have more stress, less sleep. You use more progesterone than if you're back on the beach, like you mentioned before. So I'd like to bring up another thing, and a little off what we're talking about right now. Peter Atiyah did make a quite clear point about relative risk versus absolute risk. Now, this is a complicated idea, and what we have is we have studies, and they come up with these big measures of risk, and normally these numbers are relative risk, not the absolute risk. So let me give you an example from the Women's Health Initiative. So the Women's Health Initiative, when they stopped it, they identified some increase in heart disease and some increase in breast cancer. So for the case of breast cancer, what made the headlines was a 25% increase in breast cancer risk. Remember this?
Very big. 25% increase. I had women calling my office sobbing. What do I do? What do I do? I can't live without my hormones. And one of the greatest fears women have is breast cancer. But go on, explain that number.
Okay. So that was the relative risk. And here's how they got it. So for in the group with thousands of people, they went from an incidence of breast cancer for 4 in 1,000 women to 5 in 1,000 women. And so that was one case divided by 4. That was 25% more. Of course it is. But the actual absolute risk with these numbers for the whole population and based on the data from the Women's Health Initiative really is 0.1%. So
you had 25,000.
Yes, 25% in general. And when you go
25 per thousand, and then they went up to 26, and that's a 25% increase.
No, you had 4 and 5 per thousand in the case of the women's health. So you had one more case, and all of a sudden it's a 25% increased risk. So and if you
one extra person per thousand,
right?
But this was also with the equine, the horse, urine, estrogens, and progestin, which is a synthetic. Androgen. So it had really nothing to do with natural hormones.
Yeah. The other question I would have is what's underlying cancers anyway? We know there's associations with environmental things. We know there's association with alcohol. Actually, the alcohol one is bigger than the estrogen one, although alcohol does increase your estrogen, so a bit of estrogen in there too. And insulin is huge. Why don't we ban all the sugar-laden snacks? Because they're a great promoter and initiator of cancers. We're not doing that. Why aren't we paying attention? Issue with potentially estrogens, the problem pales in relationship to insulin and glucose, but we don't really care about that, I guess. So breast cancer is complicated, and any cancer is complicated. So is our body actually trying to do us a favor? And like if for a little tumor, is it isolating, protecting the rest of our body from some toxic substances? And you'll find that if you do open up a tumor, it's got toxic stuff in there. And it's got fungus in there, and it's got just garbage. So walling off an area like a tumor does, do we have some protection? And if we're cutting out tumors and breaking them open, for instance, our body's got to start all over again and make more protection. I don't know that our philosophy with breast cancer is entirely correct. And so we do everything possible. We use radiation, which is a known cancer promoter, to treat breast cancer. I just don't understand. Do you have an opinion about this?
Well, I don't really want to go there right the second. We've got 2 minutes, so my opinion is a little longer than that. Well, let's sum it up, Carol. We've got about 2 minutes, and what I want to say is I really feel that there's so much misinformation on hormones and about healthcare in relationship to hormones, male and female. And there's such a tremendous fear of them also. And we heard it even in this talk with Atiya, who totally agrees with hormones, but he had this fear on possibly imbalance and excess, and he had fear of testosterone for women, and you know,
fear of progesterone too.
And fear of progesterone. So
he'd rather give you a fake IUD coil with a progestin than give you real progesterone.
When
you had some issues, he didn't take the time to look into what the issues were.
So what I felt very sad to hear this, because I've got lots of respect for some of these practitioners that are online, but I was so disappointed in the fact that there was so much misinformation. So before you make decisions, please look things up. Please do, because there is good information out there. Carol has it. I have it. There's very good information out there, and you can make decisions that are right for you and your body. Carol?
Yep, we're going to have to say goodbye. But I think that's great parting words, Corinne. You have to take charge of your own health. You've got to really research and make sure that you know what you're doing with your body. Don't give away your power to one practitioner, one medical institution. You have so much access is out there between different people doing, having a message, and the internet. I wouldn't make fun of Dr. Google. There's things to be found.
So thank you very much for spending this time with us, and we'll be back next week. We're thinking about trying to smash another myth.
Okay. Sounds good. I'm looking forward to it.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
So we'll be back next week. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
In conclusion, I'd like to say, remember, this information is not an attempt to diagnose or a substitute for treatment. As always, we urge you to take this and all other information we share with you up with your healthcare practitioner. Clearly, this comes under the category of taking charge of your health. Thank you so much for spending this time with us, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye. Thank you.